you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Start your Saturday with something that will grow your kiddos' brains and get their creative juices flowing. Join us at LAS in Pasadena for a morning of multilingual readings, interactive performances, and lots of kid fun. It's Super Fun Saturday on June 1st. Get your tickets at las.com/events.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Americans' confidence in police has dropped to an all-time low. That's according to a recent Gallup poll. We'll hear how those feelings are reflected in the way Angelenos view L.A. law enforcement. Plus, wondering how mail-in voting is going to work? In case you still have doubt, we're bringing in an expert to help you figure it all out. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.
LAist has a new live event series with the James Beard Foundation. We Are Where We Eat will go behind the scenes of some of your favorite LA restaurants to find out how and why they do what they do. I'm Austin Cross. Join me for the first event where we'll explore how restaurants help make a neighborhood and we'll all have something delicious to eat afterwards. It's May 22nd at the Crawford. Get your tickets now at las.com/events.
From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take Two. May Martinez, thanks for joining us today. Coming up.
Fighting a wildfire is probably the most dangerous work compared to military personnel in a combat zone.
One woman's story, training incarcerated individuals for the fire line and why it's important. The governor signed a bill allowing people to pursue this work professionally once released. That's coming up in a few minutes. We start, though, with the election. The first presidential debate is tonight. But if your mind is already made up, in California, you won't have to wait long to cast your ballot. KPCC's Libby Denkman is here to explain. And Libby, I know every registered voter in the state will be getting a ballot in the mail this year. When can we expect those ballots?
Very soon, Monday, October 5th is the deadline for county registrars to begin mailing ballots. So you could be seeing your ballot by the middle of next week. The best way to make sure that ballot reaches you in a timely manner is to double check your registration right now. Confirm your county has your current mailing address on file. It only takes a second and it'll save you a lot of worry down the line. One clue, think back if you have received any mail so far this year from your county elections office. The LA County Registrar, for example, sent out postcards and a pamphlet to let voters know they will be receiving a ballot this year, whether they signed up for it or not. And your sample ballot should also be arriving soon. In LA County, the registrar mails those out 30 to 40 days before the election. That'll give you a preview of what you will be voting on. Remember, you have until October 19th to register online to vote and request your ballot in one of 18 foreign languages. But if you miss that deadline, you can register up to and including Election Day in person.
All right. So next week, start watching our mailboxes. What should we look for, Libby? Because if it's not a check, I kind of rip things up.
Really? You rip all the mail up that's not
almost
a check? That's one policy, eh? Well, hopefully you will not be able to rip this one up because it is a hefty envelope with the official seal of your county and a logo from the post office that says official election mail. It'll say clearly that it contains vote by mail balloting material. Inside, you will see the ballot, an optional privacy sleeve if your county uses those. LA does, Orange County doesn't, and a postage paid return envelope, plus an I voted sticker because we can't miss out on that tradition. So, yes, start watching your mailbox next week. Hopefully, you will not accidentally throw it out. If you do, though, you can contact your registrar to get a new one. They'll void the old ballot or go in person to a vote center to cast that ballot.
All right. Now, we've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. What's the number one mistake people make with mail-in ballots?
they forget to sign the return envelope. There is a signature line on the outside of your return envelope that county election staff will use to check against the signature on file. It's one of the safeguards for election security in a vote-by-mail election. The number one reason ballots are rejected in California is a problem with that signature. Either you forgot it or your signature doesn't match what the registrar is expecting. The rule of thumb is to sign how you did on your driver's license. And if your ballot is rejected for any reason, state law says your registrar has to contact you to give you a chance to fix it. That's yet another reason to make sure your registrar has all of your updated contact information.
All right. What's the situation with in-person voting centers in Orange County in LA? Because I thought I saw Libby Denkman taking a picture at Dodger Stadium last week, a selfie.
You know, it was really nice to be back at Chavez Ravine. I'm not going to lie. It was a preview of the Dodger Stadium Top Deck Concourse, which will be an LA County vote center this year. In fact, a bunch of LA's professional sports venues have volunteered their huge spaces for vote centers. I mean, they've mostly been empty due to the COVID-19 pandemic. After all, there's plenty of space to stretch out. That includes Bank of California Stadium in Exposition Park, Staples Center, and the new SoFi Stadium in Inglewood. The Pomona Fairplex is also hosting in-person voting. In Orange County, the Honda Center will be a vote center. And this is a good reminder, too, that you don't have to go to a sports stadium to vote. In-person voting is going to be available at other locations, too, including some colleges and libraries. We don't have a full list of where those locations will be yet, but we expect to get that information in early October. By the way, the Dodger Stadium Vote Center will be open starting Friday, October 30th. Through Election Day, November 3rd.
All right, looking ahead to what's on the ballot, because sure, the next occupant of the White House is a big one, but what are some of the biggest local issues and races some of us are going to see?
Voters will decide who the next Los Angeles County District Attorney will be. And that race between incumbent Jackie Lacey and challenger George Gascon is one of the most consequential local elections in the country this year, because it has so many major implications for the direction of criminal justice reform in the country. The LA County Supervisor race in the 2nd District is another big one. State Senator Holly Mitchell versus LA City Councilman Herb Wesson. Supervisors are known as five little kings and queens, because they wield so much power and money, and their seats are very safe once they're elected. And one other one that might have flown under your radar is Measure J. It's a Los Angeles County specific measure that will update the county's charter if approved. It would require LA County to dedicate a minimum of 10% of its unrestricted, locally generated funds to community investment programs like housing and youth development, criminal justice diversion, things like that. And it would mean a divestment from the sheriff's department also. The county CEO told me the amendment could shave $110 million from the law enforcement budget of the county. That number has not been officially chosen. It won't be chosen until after the measure is either adopted or fails. And the supervisors voted to add Measure J to the ballot relatively late in the game. So the campaign is really just getting ramped up.
All right. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the first presidential debate is tonight. Before that, there's a local event that you can consider a kind of a pregame to the debate, right?
That's right. Tonight, our education reporter Kyle Stokes and business reporter David Wagner are teaming up to walk you through Proposition 15, which is maybe the biggest measure on the ballot. It's also known as the split roll measure. It would eliminate a large tax break for commercial property. Dave and Kyle will explain it all and explore the implications for the state tonight at 5 o'clock. And I am hoping everyone can join me this Thursday, October 1st at 6:30 p.m. when I'm hosting our virtual How Voting Works Now Q&A featuring an expert panel. We have also launched the voter game plan online with everything you need to prepare to vote in Southern California. That's at votergameplan.com or on LAist.
All right, we're going to check all of those out, and you're going to be back soon to help us through this very unique election year. That's Libby Denkman, senior politics reporter for KPCC and LAist.com. Libby, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Now, you heard us mention the debate. Listen tonight at 6 as President Trump goes up against challenger Joe Biden. The moderator is Chris Wallace from Fox News, who will be grilling the candidates on their records, the pandemic, the Supreme Court, the economy, race and violence in American cities, and the integrity of the election. We'll follow the main event with fact-checking and analysis from NPR, anchored by Audie Cornish. The first presidential debate tonight at 6 on 89.3 KPCC, because democracy needs to be heard. Moving on to one of the bigger societal issues we're grappling with right now, and that's law enforcement's role in our communities. A recent Gallup poll found that just 48% of Americans have confidence in the police. That's the lowest number since Gallup started asking the question nearly three decades ago. Relations got worse here in Los Angeles after protesters claimed widespread police brutality during the George Floyd demonstrations. Then came the killings of Andres Guardado in Gardena and Dejan Kazee in South L.A. and others. Then came the ambush against two sheriff's deputies as they sat in a parked car and the attack last weekend against an LAPD officer inside the Harbor Station. KPCC's Frank Stoltz has been following all of this. And Frank, how would you describe the state of police-community relations in the L.A. area right now?
I think it's safe to say not great. There's no local polling on the issue, but both law enforcement and community leaders I talked to describe an increasingly tense relationship. I spoke with Sheriff's Captain Dwayne Allen Jr. He commands the South L.A. station. That's in the area where there were protests after two deputies fatally shot Dejan Kazee, allegedly because he had a gun in his hand.
People are chanting that they want to know where my kids go to school and where my parents go to church for whatever reason. It seems very hostile that in my 32 years I've never seen before.
It's especially disturbing, he says, given the ambush of the two deputies in Compton earlier this month. Nobody's been arrested in that case. I also spoke with Imada Tingarides. She's a deputy chief at the LAPD. She told me her officers have had some difficult talks with residents in the wake of the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and closer to home, Kazee.
Some of those conversations are very intense. There's a lot of feelings being discussed. Can they feel the tension in some areas, in some communities? Absolutely.
And A, you won't be surprised, those communities tend to be more Black, more Latino, and poorer, and more aggressively policed. Past polls have found, and you won't be surprised by this either, that whiter, wealthier communities are generally happier with the police.
What's the view from the community, Frank?
Well, community leaders I spoke with feel the tension too, as the deputy chief says. Pastor Michael Fisher leads Greater Zion Church in Compton, started by his father as the city's first Black church in 1954. His congregation has worked hard to build a relationship with the sheriff's department there, even bringing food to the night shift.
We were under the impression that things were, in fact, getting better. And I think the anger that has erupted is a sense of betrayal.
The pastor, A, is angry.
It's as if the masks have come off, that this entire time we were working with racists.
Fisher is quick to say he doesn't believe all sheriff's deputies are racist. After all, two of his nieces work for the department, but he feels the department has a split personality.
So by day, we're having cops who are trying to get to know the community. And then by night, and I'm speaking figuratively, you have this other regime that take their power and they abuse it.
Now, what else did you hear from people about police community relations in LA?
Well, the issue of trust came up over and over again. Patty Guerra is with the Community Coalition. That's the South LA organization founded by Congresswoman Karen Bass 30 years ago. She told me how she doesn't trust letting her brothers drive when they visit.
When they visit me here in South Central LA, I prefer to be the driver instead of them because in our neighborhoods, like Black and brown men are specifically targeted.
Guerra called out the sheriff's department in particular because of Sheriff Alex Villanueva's refusal to cooperate with the sheriff's civilian oversight commission.
When we have a sheriff that is not being held accountable, it's really hard to believe and trust what's being put out, specifically from the department.
Villanueva said recently that those who don't trust his department represent a very narrow segment of the community. And he said the average person on the street appreciates law enforcement.
Frank, I'm curious, did the police you spoke with talk about trust as well?
Yes. Sheriff's Captain Dwayne Allen is frustrated. Some people don't trust the department.
People right now are very quick to make judgments on things. Nobody has any patience anymore, and everybody kind of feels like they know exactly what happened right now, and your judgments are based on preconceived notions.
He's hoping the placement of body-worn cameras on deputies starting next month will go a long way toward building trust. But that doesn't seem to be the case entirely with the LAPD, which also is facing a crisis of trust. You know, the LAPD does have body cameras. Deputy Chief Tingarides says it takes more than body cameras.
I think the biggest challenge right now is law enforcement understanding the history and the culture and why people are feeling the way that they feel.
Without that understanding, she says, cops will never gain the trust they need or deserve. So the bottom line, A, I think it's fair to say policing in Los Angeles, like everywhere else, is at a crossroads. And you might say people who have taken to the streets are not waiting for the LAPD or the sheriff to decide which direction to take.
That's KPCC's criminal justice correspondent Frank Stoltz talking with us about the current state of relations between law enforcement and the community here in Southern California. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, how much do you think your American citizenship is worth? Yeah, an actual dollar amount. Well, if you were born in the U.S., you know it's free. But if you weren't, there is a price, an actual price, which very soon could go up by more than 80% by this Friday. Find out why when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Start your Saturday with something that will grow your kiddos' brains and get their creative juices flowing. Join us at LAS for a morning of multilingual story times, interactive performances, art making, and lots of kid fun. Bring the whole fam and join us for a super fun Saturday at LAS in Pasadena on June 1st. Tickets at las.com/events. See you there.
How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. In the past 20 years, the cost of becoming a citizen in the United States has risen dramatically. In December 2016, the Obama administration increased fees for immigration services by about 21% overall. And now the Trump administration is looking at another price hike come this Friday, October 2nd. That one would increase the current application for citizenship by more than 80% to more than $1,000. For more on what that could mean for the future of many immigrants, we have Arturo Vargas with us. He is the chief executive officer of the National Association of Latino and Elected Officials Educational Fund. Arturo, let's talk about the fees that people are looking at. How much of a dollar increase are we talking about here? What will people have to pay to become citizens ultimately?
Well, good afternoon, A. It's good to speak with you again. We're talking about an 83% increase in the cost of the naturalization application, taking it to $1,170 per person to apply to become a U.S. citizen. This is the largest increase we have seen in decades, both in absolute dollar amount and in percentage for the naturalization increase.
So, Arturo, what is the Trump administration saying about why they are wanting the increase?
Well, they're saying that they need the increase in order to pay for services that are provided by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. However, in looking at their analysis of why they're trying to increase the fees, it's clear that they're trying to put the burden of paying for immigration enforcement on the backs of people who are applying for services for immigration, contrary to what the law requires. In fact, this is why this increase is being challenged in three different lawsuits for violation of the American Procedures Act, violations of other federal law that has to do with how fees are spent, and also in violation of who's right now running the departments of Department of Homeland Security and USCIS, who appear to be serving illegally because they haven't been placed properly by this administration.
And Turo, just for my own information's sake, is the $1,170, is that something that has to be paid all at once or can it be paid in installments? How does that go?
There's no layaway or payment plan to be a citizen. You got to pay it up front. In fact, right now, applicants can apply for fee waivers. If you are and can show that you are of low income, part or all of the fee can be waived. However, the proposal being advanced by the administration would get rid of most of the fee waivers as well. So not only will it make it more expensive, but will also take away any kind of financial assistance that the prior administration had put in place to try to make citizenship accessible.
An 83% hike, that's a lot. What impact, Arturo, could such a large hike have on the number of immigrants deciding to become citizens?
Well, you know, here at Nailua Educational Fund, we've been providing assistance to people applying to be citizens for over 30 years. And we've been studying what are the barriers to people applying to become citizens? What's keeping them from submitting that application once they become eligible? And we've identified three major barriers. One is a lack of urgency. Some people feel that being a green card holder is good enough in terms of being able to live their lives in this country. Number two, many people have fear of the test, that they may not have sufficient knowledge of English or civics to be able to meet the requirements to show that they're eligible to be citizens. And number three, it's the cost. That has always been the most powerful barrier to keeping people from applying to become a citizen. The best way to make citizenship inaccessible is to simply make it too expensive for a legal permanent resident to apply.
Is that what you've been hearing from folks that are facing this price hike, that this could be the backbreaker for them?
That has historically been the case in our research, and our research has been through polls and focus groups, as well as conversations with applicants when they come to our one-on-one volunteer assistance events to help them fill out the applications, which of course we no longer can hold because of the pandemic, that the cost has always been the most significant barrier to people applying to become a citizen.
So I got to imagine, Arturo, that there might have been people that were hoping to vote in the November election. That could completely blow up these plans.
Well, the fact is that no one's going to be able to vote in this election if they didn't apply to be a citizen about 2 years ago. Because on top of everything else, this administration has been slowing down the process. Backlogs have increased. It now has taken up to 2 years for somebody to become a citizen from the point of the submission of their application to when they take the oath. That has been a wait delay that we haven't seen in decades in this country as well. Someone applying today to become a citizen, well, hopefully they can get through the process in time to vote in 2022.
We're talking to Arturo Vargas, CEO of Nailua. I know immigrants come from all different parts of the world. Which communities in particular, Arturo, might be most affected by the price hike?
Well, there are presently about 8.4 million legal permanent residents in the United States who are eligible to become citizens. That means they've been green card holders for at least 5 years. Of those, the majority, 4.4, are Latino legal permanent residents. The majority of them from Mexico, but also from El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, South America, the Dominican Republic, throughout Latin America. 4.4 million legal permanent residents today who could become U.S. citizens if they were to begin the process and put together not just their applications, but gather the resources to pay for that fee.
And with immigration services being transferred online during COVID-19, how has that changed the process for those applying for citizenship?
You know, one of the things that my predecessor, Dr. Harry Pachon, realized that the only way to be able to help people through the citizenship process was to really help them, walk them through the process and provide one-on-one assistance in completing the application, which is why Nailua Educational Fund and so many other organizations have pioneered and implemented these citizenship application assistance workshops. We can't do that anymore in person. And for the past few months, we've had to try to do that virtually, which has dramatically limited our ability to provide that one-on-one help and assistance to people. Today, if you want to apply to become a citizen, you must do it online, and it can be a very complicated application. And as we all know, government applications are not the most intuitive, but one that is pages and pages long can be very discouraging.
That's Arturo Vargas, Chief Executive Officer of the National Association of Latino and Elected Officials Educational Fund. Arturo, thank you very much for the information.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, staying with immigration issues, as the country heads into another election year, filmmaker Paola Mendoza brings us a new novel depicting a bleak dystopian future in the U.S. that she worries could become a reality if the current administration stays in power. In her young adult book, Sanctuary, it's the year 2032. The government has built a wall that separates the United States from Mexico, and immigration sweeps have followed. Mendoza, who also helped organize the Women's March back in 2017, says her book is inspired by her trips to the southern border during the spring of 2018, where families were being separated upon entering the U.S.
My book, Sanctuary, tells the story of Vali. She is a 16-year-old undocumented girl that lives in Vermont. The world of Sanctuary takes place in 2032. The world is set with a dictatorial authoritarian regime that is in power in the United States. It's anti-immigrant to its core. The federal government has erected a wall between Mexico and the United States. The president is in office now for his third term, and all citizens are tracked. And so what that means is anyone that is here, born in the United States, they have a chip in their wrists, and the government, the federal government, is able to track you, and you have to basically scan your chip throughout everywhere you go. What that means is that many undocumented immigrants have been forced to have counterfeit chips, and these counterfeit chips are very sketchy. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. So Vali has a counterfeit chip, her mom has a counterfeit chip too, and her little brother, Ernie, is 8 years old, he's a U.S. citizen. The world begins, and this is the story of Vali. She's living a regular life as best she can in Vermont. And then suddenly the federal government deploys a deportation force like they've never seen before, and they start rounding up undocumented immigrants. In response to that, the state of California decides to secede from the union, and they put out a call and say that they're sanctuary for all undocumented immigrants. So Vali and her mom decide that they are going to trek across the United States during the most dangerous time that they've been in the United States to get to sanctuary in California. The idea for Sanctuary came to me at the height of family separation. In 2018, I traveled along with the migrant caravan, and the migrant caravan was about 7,000 people that were walking from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. They were walking north to the southern border to the United States to ask for asylum. And I went and I spent maybe 3 weeks total with people on the caravan and heard their stories. And it was thousands of families and thousands of children that were walking. Some children that were walking as young as 3, 4, 5 with blisters on their feet, walking 18 miles a day for months on end. And why people would do that is very similar to the reasons that Vali and the people she meets along the way were fleeing to California, because their lives depended on finding safety somewhere, because they could not survive. Their families could not survive in their home, whether it be because of gang violence, because of poverty, because of climate crisis. There was no way for these families to survive. So in the case of the caravan, they chose to walk for months on end, miles and miles a day. In the case of Sanctuary, we paralleled that story by having our characters, instead of migrating from south to north, our characters are migrating from east to west to find sanctuary. But the moment and the reason is the same, and that is because it's a historical fact that humans have been migrating since we first were placed on this earth. We've been migrating for the benefit of our future, and it's not going to stop. I wanted to tell young people, undocumented young people in particular, that you do belong here. You are here. You are part of this fabric of this nation. This is your home. I wanted to celebrate them. The definition of sanctuary is to give refuge and safety. And so in this moment in time, at the height of a pandemic, during a very tense political moment, some sort of transition will happen, whether it's Biden or a re-election of Trump or going through a transition, that we need one another in order to provide each other safety and refuge. And that is ultimately what Valley realizes as well.
Sanctuary was released earlier in September and can be found anywhere you get your books. All right, when it comes to fighting the seemingly never-ending number of wildfires burning up California, it would seem to make sense to have as many trained hands on deck to beat the flames back. Well, the state recently cleared the way for that. Find out how when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm LAist education reporter Julia Barajas. Community colleges transform people's lives, so I explore how students fresh out of high school or going back to school for the first time in years achieve their goals and how colleges help them do that.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Hi, I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, and we are back for another round.
This is clearly an NPR audience.
Yeah, I think they're so smart. What the hell?
My guests this time are actor Vella Lavelle and author Amanda Montell, whose new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, is out now. Join us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum for book talk, trivia, and hot takes. Tickets can be found at laist.com/events.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. Yeah, as you just heard with Austin Cross, their fires continue to chew up the state. More than 18,000 firefighters continue to battle the 27 major fires burning all across California. The most recent one being the Glass Fire, which is threatening the state's Napa and Sonoma counties and has burned 36,000 acres in just a couple of days. Meanwhile, closer to home, the Bobcat Fire looks like it'll be contained by the end of October. Though firefighters have gotten a handle on it, there is concern about the warmer temperatures and high winds expected to come our way this week. Now, these massive fires have been burning across the state all summer long, and firefighters have been working diligently to put them out. In the midst of one of the most aggressive seasons in our history, California Governor Gavin Newsom recently signed a bill aimed at creating a pathway to employment for the men and women helping to fight these fires while in prison. Assembly Bill 2147 would allow incarcerated firefighters to have their records expunged, essentially clearing the way for them to become eligible for professional firefighting jobs upon release. Someone who directly understands the impact and implications of this is Romarilyn Ralston. She spent 15 of the 20 years she was incarcerated working on a fire crew, helping to train other women to do the same. All right, so let's start with the basics, Romarilyn. For those who may not be familiar with what incarcerated fire crews do, tell us a little bit about these CAL FIRE conservation programs and the role the program participants play in fighting actual wildfires.
First of all, as a trainer within the prison, not particularly attached to a fire crew, but attached to the fire camp program, what happens inside of the camp training program is pretty intense. It's not an irrigation system. Fighting a wildfire is, I think, probably the most dangerous work compared to military personnel in a combat zone. The amount of personnel that it takes to contain or to distinguish a fire is unbelievable. So the preparation that goes into it mentally, you know, when you're facing something like that is incredible, because you know that your life is on the line.
From the moment someone wants to do this, or at least is getting ready to do this, how long does it take to train a firefighter in these conservation programs that you're involved in?
I think the training time varies from person to person, because individuals who enter the prison system, they enter at different physical levels. And so if they pass a certain level of physical fitness through the pretest, then they move right into intermediate training and then maybe advanced training, depending upon how they test out. Then they are moved to the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection classroom training, where they learn about fire science. And that takes about 32 to 40 hours a week. And then they are placed on like a field crew where they go out and learn how to use those tools, the McLeod, Pulaski, deploy a fire shelter, cut line, remove debris, maybe even use a chainsaw. Wow. So it could take 12 weeks of training.
What's it like though for when these women get out there for their first real fire, though? Because one thing I do know is that training is one thing, but when you're out there, you know, feeling and understanding and trying to fight the real thing, that's a different scenario.
That's true. It's a totally different scenario from training to actually being on the side of a mountain and seeing that fire coming towards you. I've never experienced it as a trainer, but what I've heard from friends who have experienced it is that it's one of the most scariest things that they've ever had to confront. But because of the training that they received, they were ready to confront that.
Now, you mentioned the bill that Governor Gavin Newsom signed, 2147, that would create an employment path for incarcerated firefighters upon release. Marilyn, how big of a deal is this to you? I mean, what are the implications that you could see down the road?
I think Assembly Bill 2147 is a huge step towards equity and justice for the work that incarcerated firefighters have put in to saving the lives and property of California. Every year, it's estimated that incarcerated firefighters save approximately $100 million to the state. So acknowledging their expertise and the value of their work and sacrifice is huge. I am ecstatic that Governor Newsom has signed this bill so quickly and very grateful, providing a pathway for formerly incarcerated people who have this high level of training and experience and earn a living wage. It's huge. And it also provides expungement of their criminal records, which opens up this pathway to this type of licensing. And as a first responder, you know, it's going to really change the way that they not only see themselves, but how their family members, their children. This is going to promote intergenerational change.
Now, I want to ask you, because you mentioned equity for the work. It's the elephant in the room, I think, here, Marilyn, is the fact that this bill, while it acknowledges the skilled nature of incarcerated crews' work, it does nothing to address the lack of meaningful compensation for that work while these individuals are still on prison crews. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that all incarcerated people are just labor to the state, slave labor. You know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done so that incarcerated people who are assigned to these types of positions are given more pay for their work and recognized while they're doing that work. The prison system is, you know, it has never acknowledged the labor of incarcerated people. And this is just, I think, another way that we can continue to change laws in California to help support those people that we use to take care of the state.
Do you think it would have been better for the governor to work on a more comprehensive bill that included a wage adjustment element, even though maybe it would have taken more time? Or is the perspective more, you know, we pocket this win now and then work toward the other changes later?
That's a great question. Sometimes passing a comprehensive piece of legislation is very time consuming. Passing AB 2147 and opening up the pathway for folks post-release to get employment, to get licensed, to get onto these crews and continue to do the work that they're trained for is amazing. Yes, I would have loved to have seen a more comprehensive bill that raised their wages for their labor while they are incarcerated, and then also opened up this pathway to expungement and to employment post-release. But sometimes it's one step at a time. So I'm appreciative of this step. And I hope that next year we can do something around incarcerated labor and raise the wages for not just our incarcerated firefighters, but for a lot of the men and women who are producing products for the state at 8 cents an hour or nothing at all.
That's from Marilyn Ralston, formerly incarcerated firefighter. She's also the Project Rebound Program Director at Cal State Fullerton. Marilyn, thanks a lot. All right, now to the military. A Pentagon task force is looking at why the Navy doesn't have more African Americans in top jobs. Only a handful of Navy admirals are Black, and none of them are at the highest two ranks. Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project, a six-station collaboration to cover military life and veterans issues.
The problem starts at the top. Out of 268 admirals in the U.S. Navy, only 10 are African American. Most of them are rear admirals like Alvin Halsey, who is running the Navy task force.
That's pretty small.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Right now, there are no African-American admirals at the two highest ranks. Building an admiral is a 20 to 30 year commitment, Halsey says. It's not just about test scores and performance reviews. Someone has to be willing to guide that young officer.
As a Black officer in the Navy, I'll tell you that I'd mentor more people that don't look like me, that look like me. Sure, mathematics, right? But I will tell you also, because there's very few guys who've come before me in small numbers, someone who don't look like me had to reach out and engage and make a difference in my career.
African Americans are 13% of the population, but only 9% of naval officers. So the pipeline starts off small. Then, somewhere along the way, many people just become exhausted, says Keith Green, a lieutenant commander who retired in the 1990s. He recently wrote the book Black Officer, White Navy.
It is not simply just unconscious bias. There are active behaviors that are happening to people because they don't like working for a Black person or a minority, and they don't like having, you know, one be their supervisor.
Not everyone an African-American officer encounters is a problem, Green says, but the extra effort to work around those who are takes its toll on their career.
Not only do you have to do all the other stressful things that any military person has to do, you have to play that double game of trying to figure out why you're being treated differently or what's happening to you, why is something happening to you that isn't happening to other people.
Retired Rear Admiral Sinclair Harris heads the National Naval Officers Association, which has worked for 50 years to promote diversity in the sea services. He says it takes hundreds of ensigns to eventually make one admiral, or what the Navy calls flag officers.
You got to bring more people in the beginning so that the quality cut that you're going to have, especially when you get to senior officer and get to flag officer, you have enough people in the pot.
He calls it Death Valley, that point where junior officers opt to end their careers. Graduating from the Naval Academy is the most well-worn path to admiral, but less than 6% of the current class at the Naval Academy is African American. The Academy is not the only path. Admiral Harris was rejected when he applied at the beginning of his career. Harris says one solution is mentoring officers who come through less traditional paths.
When you only have one out of 20, diverse candidates going up for a flag officer in a certain community, and they decide, hey, you know what? I just got this high-paying job at IBM. Guess what? Now you're down to zero, and you got to look through that pipeline, and that pipeline is anemic.
The Navy is more diverse at lower ranks. 20% of enlisted sailors are African-American. Force Master Chief Hubin Phillips is part of the One Navy Task Force, which is looking at how to end discrimination in the ranks.
Throughout my 31 years, where I've seen racism or discrimination personally against me,
I knew what the policy was, right? I knew that it was wrong. But when you're in a minority, you just kind of put your head down, right? You kind of figure out, you think about self-preservation, you think about your family, you think about the bigger picture.
At the moment, the Navy is encouraging enlisted and officers alike to speak up. One Navy task force is scheduled to issue its report in December. I'm Steve Walsh in San Diego.
I realize I may be called overcautious or a worrywart, but there are a lot of fun things I'm just not going to do. I don't feel safe around crowds. No movies, no eating out. Thing is, though, there's now something on LA's calendar that's going to be really tough to turn down. Find out what it is when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Earlier this month, Rose Cerna received a letter in the mail.
Your tenancy is being terminated by reason of the fact
the journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm LAist senior housing reporter David Wagner. I help Southern Californians, including renters and landlords, navigate the region's affordable housing crisis. And I help you stay on top of the ever-changing renter protections and housing policies.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
We're all dressing up. I can show you worlds of fantasy. Be anyone you wanna be. You could be Batman, even if you weigh 300 pounds. It happens here at Comic-Con. And Comic-Con.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, and you can also get us on the NPR One app. I'm E. Martinez. In the world of COVID, huge gatherings have either been canceled or have gone virtual. But news broke yesterday that one pop culture event is planning to go ahead in person in downtown LA this December, and that's LA Comic-Con. Far smaller than its more well-known San Diego sibling, this three-day fan convention could be the city's first large event to take place as the pandemic shut everything down. For more on this, we go now to Mike Rowe, arts and entertainment reporter for LAS. So, Mike, in case someone doesn't know the joy of Comic-Con, what is LA Comic-Con? Paint a picture of how big it is, what's the setting, and what happens there.
You know, LA Comic-Con packs the LA Convention Center with fans, exhibitors, panels. According to the convention, they draw more than 100,000 attendees every year. They come out to see their favorite comic book creators, actors, in some cases, actors slash former wrestlers.
This is my very first time at LA Comic-Con, and I got to tell you right now, I'm fired up. Yes, finally, The Rock.
Yeah, there's a lot of people there. There's a lot of people there dressed up in all kinds of different outfits. And yeah, people get to see maybe the stars of the next movie that's coming out or the next TV show. But how have crowds historically been handled at previous LA Comic-Cons?
You know, the convention was criticized in its early years. It used to be called Kamikaze Expo. They left fans out in the heat for hours in long lines. Fire marshals shut the doors and wouldn't allow more people inside. So they have a history of having some trouble with handling crowds. And also, you know, they draw a lot of people and really pack them in there. So it's a little concerning.
So, okay, what do the organizers say about maybe precautions that they're planning to take this year that's maybe different than say other years?
You know, they are requiring masks. They are reducing their maximum capacity. You know, the biggest change they're making this year is they're renting the whole convention center to allow for more space per person. You know, the convention notes they have 800,000 square feet of event space available. You know, they haven't had as much space in the past. They also said, though, they have 400,000 square feet of indoor and outdoor space to manage lines. So, you know, a third of the space there is going to be for waiting. And so you may be in a space that isn't the most fun space for quite a while. They also say, you know, this added space gives each person the room to stay 6 feet apart from each other. Mm. But, you know, the chances of that actually happening throughout the convention seem pretty slim. Yeah. with more than 10,000 people in there at once.
I was thinking, Mike, okay, so I was really trying to figure out a way I would do it because I've been mm-hmm. like staying away from just about everything. But I would have to dress up in the costume of a superhero or a supervillain that has their mouth and nose completely covered. So Spider-Man would be an option, right? Bane as a villain, if you wanted Bane, Jason, if you're into like horror stuff. So that's really the only, I'm not going to do it. Believe me. It kills me that I'm not going to do it, but I'm not going to do it. But that would be the only way is if I could somehow make sure that I am 100% covered and more than 6 feet away from other people. So, Mike, I'm wondering, since you're in tune with this, how have fans been reacting to this news of LA Comic-Con happening in person?
You know, on social media, the reaction appears to have been largely negative. There's a lot of dark humor around about the continued threat of COVID-19 this soon. I saw in the responses to LAS tweets, there was the top tweet with everybody favoriting it was a Sixth Sense I See Dead People joke. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there very worried right now. There's a lot of concern about going to an in-person thing. You know, Comic-Con this year went virtual. Pretty much every other convention has gone virtual. And, you know, it's not even technically allowed by the state yet to open up events like this.
Yeah, and you know what, Mike, you and I know both the sense of humor around comic book people tends to be gallows type humor a lot of the times.
Yes.
I could totally see someone dressing up as the actual virus itself and roaming the halls, right?
I'm sure that's going to be seen if this thing actually happens this December.
We'll see. Now, finally, Mike, while we have you, just a few minutes ago, Disney announced a huge layoffs among its amusement park employees. You were recently on a press call with the head of that division. What do you make of the news?
You know, you could really hear in that call sort of the desperation that was felt by Disney folks. The call very much was like they're making a plea to the governor to allow them to reopen. And now with this news, you can sort of see what the stakes were, what was on the table for them if they didn't get that permission to allow the parks to reopen with 28,000 employees being laid off at all levels, especially from the parks. You know, it's the same pressure that LA Comic-Con is under. You know, all these event spaces, all these theaters are feeling that stress because they don't know when they'll be allowed to hold events again, and they're trying to, you know, figure it all out.
You know, Mike, I think this chat or interview, our segment here, was just about two places that I still won't go to. I mean, I just
probably. Yeah, I'll be out there trying to cover stuff and see what it's like, but I'll be staying safely distanced.
Mike Rowe is the arts and entertainment reporter for our website, LAIST. You can read all his stuff on LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thank you, eh?
All right, before we go today, we've got to call out the LA sports fans because tomorrow, Wednesday, will be a first in Los Angeles history. Both the Lakers and Dodgers will be in playoff games at the exact same time. The Lakers start at 6, the Dodgers start at 7. I mean, it's really an embarrassment of riches. So we want to know how you plan to watch and celebrate this historic LA moment. How do you choose to watch and how? And which team gets first priority on your TV? Give us a call, leave us a message on our voicemail at 626-583-5281. That's 626-583-5281. You can also drop us a note on Facebook or Twitter. We're at Take Two. And also, don't forget, you can listen tonight at 6 o'clock as President Trump and challenger Joe Biden face off in their first presidential debate. The moderator, Chris Wallace from Fox News, he'll be grilling the candidates on the records, the pandemic, the Supreme Court, the economy, race and violence in American cities, and also the integrity of the election. We're going to follow the main event with fact-checking and analysis from NPR, anchored by Audie Cornish. The first presidential debate tonight at 6 on 89.3 KPCC, because democracy needs to be heard. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's actually good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
As a farmer's son from a desert region in California, J.B. Hamby thinks a lot about water.
I spent a lot of time digging up history, particularly about water, which is the origins of the Imperial Valley.
How this 28-year-old became the youngest lead negotiator on the Colorado River ever, and how he could shape the most consequential negotiations to date. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water dealmaker, wherever you get podcasts.